them badly managed. Regardless, the settlers rushed in. Populations of Minnesota, Kansas, and Nebraska doubled or tripled. The Dakotas went from 14,000 residents after the Civil War to 500,000 in 20 years. In 1889, the Cherokee Strip in northern Oklahoma was purchased from Native Americans and thrown open to settlement, and by 1900, the Oklahoma Territory had a population of about 800,000. Most of the farmers faced a blizzard of hardships: drought, grasshopper invasions, prairie fires, and, well, blizzards. There was even foreign competition. In the 1870s, crop failures in Europe helped drive up prices and open markets for American farmers. But in the 1880s, crop prices fell as new producers in Australia and India came on the scene. More and more farmers in the West found themselves in the same plight as those in the Civil War-torn South. The number of farms that were either mortgaged or farmed by tenant farmers steadily increased as the last 20 years of the century passed. Still, between 1870 and 1900, the number of American acres under cultivation more than doubled, from 407 million to 841 million acres. The frontier had been mined, ranched, and farmed into submission. Happy 100th America! In 1871, Congress decided to put on a big to-do to celebrate America's 100th birthday. It took a while to raise the dough, but on May 10, 1876, 13 giant bells chimed, 100 cannons fired, and an 800-voice choir sang the Hallelujah Chorus to the Open U.S. Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia. The fair, spread over a 248-acre park, featured exhibits from all over the world, but the highlights were the proud displays of Yankee know-how. Crowds, which included President Ulysses Grant and Emperor Dom Pedro II of Brazil, gasped and gaped at the largest steam engine ever built up to that time, an icebox that used ammonia as its refrigerant, and a printing press that printed, cut, and sorted pages for up to an hour at a time. The first prize for new inventions went to Alexander Graham Bell for a device he called the telephone. The Brazilian emperor put the thing to his ear and quickly dropped it, exclaiming, "My God, it talks!" But Bell's invention drew smaller crowds than an exotic exhibit from Central America. It featured a strange fruit called the banana. Ousting undesirables. General Philip Sheridan never said, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." What he did say, however, was just as bad. "The only good Indians I ever saw were dead." There were plenty of dead Native Americans by 1876. When Columbus arrived, there were probably 1 million to 1.5 million Native Americans living in what is now the United States. By the time of the Civil War, that number had dropped to about 300,000, with two-thirds of them living on the Great Plains. The Plains Indians generally tolerated the white man crossing their territory on the way to California and Oregon. But when the newcomers began to settle in, tensions grew and both sides resorted to violence. In 1862, several bands of Dakota went on the offensive in Minnesota against encroaching settlers, killing more than 700 before the militia defeated them and hanged 38 of the tribe's leaders. In 1864, John Shivington, a Colorado militia colonel, attacked a band of Cheyenne at Sand Creek, Colorado, and killed 133 people, most of them women and children. Many white Americans were appalled at Shivington's brutality. After the Civil War was over, a debate began in earnest on what to do about the Indian problem. Ideas ranged from extermination to reservations, to ending tribal customs and forcing Native Americans to adopt white culture, a process known as acculturation. All the ideas were tried to varying degrees. Between 1859 and 1876, soldiers and Native Americans fought at least 200 pitched battles and signed 370 treaties. "They made us promises more than I can remember," noted one Sioux leader, "but they never kept but one. They promised to take our land, and they did. They also all but wiped out the American bison, more popularly, if scientifically inaccurately, known as buffalo, which to the Plains Indians was a walking department store. The tribes not only ate bison, but also wore clothes and blankets from it, and used its bones for tools and its dried dung for fire fuel. In 1840, an estimated 40 million of the animals roamed the plains. But bison were dumber than rocks when it came to being hunted, placidly grazing while hunters with long-range rifles picked them off one by one for their hides, their meat, or just for the heck of it. By 1875, only 1 million were left. By 1893, less than 1,000. The Plains Indians were starved into submission far more than they were outfought. In 1868, after a series of indecisive battles, both sides agreed to a grand scheme in which two large reservations would be created, one in Oklahoma and one that took in all of western South Dakota. That included the Black Hills, which were sacred to the Sioux, a group of Native American tribes that included the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota. Putting up a fight. 6 years later, an expedition led by Colonel George Armstrong Custer discovered gold in the Black Hills. White prospectors poured into the area. The federal government, powerless to stop them, offered to buy the land from the Native Americans, but was refused. The last great war against the Native Americans began, and for the first time, the Plains tribes united into a formidable fighting force. On June 25, 1876, the U.S. 7th Cavalry Regiment, led by Custer, rashly attacked a Native American encampment at the Little Bighorn River in Montana. It proved to be populated by 2,500 warriors. Custer and nearly 40% of his men were killed. Custer's last stand horrified people in the East as well as the West, and greatly diminished sympathy for the Native Americans' situation. The battle proved to be the beginning of the end for the Plains Indians. Over the next decade, tribe after tribe was gradually worn down by hunger and continual pursuit by the army. What happened to the Plains tribes was repeated throughout the West. The Apache in Arizona, the Crow and Blackfoot in Montana, the Ute in Colorado, the Nez Perce in Idaho, all were decimated by hunger, disease, and harassment by the whites. In 1887, Congress passed a law called the Dawes Act that divided land into individual allotments for Native Americans as part of an effort to turn them into small farmers. It also provided for an education system and eventual U.S. citizenship. However well-intentioned the law was, it didn't work. Most Native Americans didn't want to be farmers or U.S. citizens, and the education system never amounted to much. Many Native Americans eventually signed away their land for a few cents an acre to speculators, who promptly resold it to settlers for a few dollars an acre. Remember, in 1890, a misunderstanding led to a cavalry attack on a group of Minneconjou and Hunkpapa Lakota who were under military escort near a creek called Wounded Knee in South Dakota. The soldiers killed more than 200 men, women, and children, and then left their bodies in the snow for 3 days before burying them in a mass grave. It was the last major violence between the Native Americans and whites, and a tragic and horrifyingly typical response to America's Indian problem. I quit. I am tired of fighting. The old men are all dead. It is cold, and we have no blankets. The little children are freezing to death. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. Nez Perce, Chief Joseph, before surrendering to U.S. Army troops, 1877. Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse was named after his father, after proving himself in battle, which was probably a good thing, because in his early years he was called Curly. Born around 1842, near the Belle Fouche River in South Dakota, the Lakota, Sioux warrior, began his fight against the white invaders in 1865. He became known as a daring fighter who used tricks and guerrilla tactics well. In 1866, he helped lure 80 soldiers into an ambush in which all of them were killed. 11 months after leading the combined tribes against Custer at the Little Bighorn, Crazy Horse surrendered to troops that had been relentlessly harassing his band. He was taken to Fort Robinson, Wyoming, where he was held for several months. "They say we massacred him, Custer," he said during his captivity. "But he would have done the same thing to us had we not defended ourselves and fought to the last. Our first impulse was to escape, but we were so hemmed in that we had to fight." In September 1877, while still in custody, he was stabbed to death by a soldier under questionable circumstances. Crazy Horse became a mythic figure among Native Americans of all tribes. Legalizing discrimination. While white America was pushing the Native Americans to adopt white ways and become part of white culture, it was pushing to keep African Americans out. Reconstruction had failed to give blacks equal rights, and a conservative U.S. Supreme Court ensured the failure would last another 50 or 60 years. Remember, in 1883, the court ruled the federal government had no right to interfere with discrimination by private enterprises or individuals. In 1896, in a case called Plessy v. Ferguson, it decided states had the right to legally segregate public facilities, from schools to trains, as long as the separate facilities were equal in quality, which rarely, if ever, occurred. And in 1899, the court went a step further by ruling that states could erect new schools for white kids only, even if schools for black kids weren't available. Encouraged by the decisions, southern states passed what are called Jim Crow laws, named after a popular song that depicted African Americans as shiftless children, which not only tried to completely separate the races, but also take away most of the rights they had been accorded by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Blacks couldn't serve on juries, represent themselves in court, or drink from the same public drinking fountains as whites. If they quit a job, they could be arrested for vagrancy. They also established elaborate tests that black would-be voters had to take to get a ballot. Black voting levels dropped like a boulder off a bridge. In addition to the Jim Crow laws, the South also averaged 130 lynchings a year in the 1890s. They were so commonplace, they were sometimes advertised in advance in newspapers. The North generally shrugged at the Jim Crow laws and ignored the lynchings. "The Negro's day is over," observed Yale professor William Graham Sumner. "He is out of fashion." Even the best-known African-American leader of the day was not ready to challenge the injustices. Born into slavery, Booker T. Washington had become a schoolteacher, the founder of a major vocational school in Alabama called the Tuskegee Institute, and an eloquent advocate of African Americans improving themselves economically. To improve their economic situations, Washington urged blacks to accommodate whites when it came to demands for segregation, in return for white help in obtaining black schools and economic opportunity. The wisest among my race understand that the agitation of questions of social equality is the extremest of folly, he argued. White America didn't care much for Chinese immigrants either. Known as the Yellow Peril, many Chinese were brought to America to work on the railroads at half the wages paid to white workers. As a result, they were viewed as a competitive labor threat to American-born workers. Anti-Chinese riots broke out in San Francisco in 1877. In 1882, Congress passed a law prohibiting all Chinese immigration for 10 years. The ban, called the Chinese Exclusion Act, was later extended to last indefinitely and wasn't repealed until 1943. Cramming into cities. Remember, the law that excluded immigration by Chinese also banned criminals, the mentally ill or disabled, and all those likely to end up as public charity cases. But otherwise, America's front door was wide open, and people poured in. Between 1866 and 1915, 25 million immigrants came to the United States. Most of them came from Italy and southeastern Europe, but they also came from Scandinavia, Russia, Poland, Germany, Ireland, England, and France. By 1910, 15% of the country's total population was foreign-born. Most came to escape hard economic times at home, despotic governments, or both. Often, their expectations were unrealistically high. America is all puddings and pie, enthused one young man as he stepped off the ship in New York. Slum life. All the fresh air that enters these stairs comes from the hall door that is forever slamming. The sinks are in the hallway, that all tenants may have access, and all be poisoned alike by the summer stenches. Here is a door. Listen, that slow, hacking cough, that tiny, helpless wail. What do they mean? The child is dying of measles. With half a chance, it might have lived, but it had none. Reporter Jacob Rees, in How the Other Half Lives, 1890. Despite the warning of a popular immigrant guidebook to forget your past, your customs, and your ideals, many of the new Americans clung to their own languages, customs, and cuisines, and gravitated to communities populated by others from their country. The presence of so many immigrants in so short a time caused alarm in some natives, who feared the newcomers would weaken their chances in the job market and pollute American culture. But it wasn't until 1921, after World War I had created millions of refugees in Europe, that Congress tightened immigration policies concerning Europeans. In the meantime, as much as 80% of the immigrant wave settled in northern cities. By the turn of the century, more than a third of Chicago's populace was foreign-born, and there were more Irish in New York City than were in Ireland. The immigrants weren't the only newcomers in town, because there were plenty of American-born country folks moving to urban areas as well. By 1900, 30 million Americans lived in cities, about a third of all U.S. residents. The number of cities larger than 100,000 increased from 9 to 50 between 1860 and 1910. But many of the big cities were festering sores. In those areas, fire protection, street cleaning, sewage systems, garbage collection, and water treatment barely existed. The Chicago River was an open sewer. Baltimore sewers emptied into the tidal basin, and in the summer heat, journalist H.L. Mencken wrote, it smelled like a billion polecats. Housing was often designed to cram the most people into the least space. It wasn't uncommon for 24 four-room apartments to be built on a 2,500-square-foot lot. Tenement slums took on fitting names such as Hell's Kitchen, Bone Alley, or Poverty Gap. Gradually, things improved in the major urban areas. No one, rich or poor, wanted to live in filth, and after the link between disease and poor sanitation was firmly established, city leaders began to develop adequate sewage and water systems. Public transit systems, based on streetcars or trolleys, were put in place. But none of it happened overnight, and more than a few farmers-turned-city dwellers must have yearned more than once to be home on the range. Inventing Big Business. As America reached young adulthood in the last part of the 19th century, it began to shake off its rural roots and become an industrial city slicker. From 1859 to 1899, the value of the country's manufactured products rose 622%, from $1.8 billion to $13 billion, and America became the world's leading manufacturer. It rode its way to the top on the train. Building the railroads. The railroad system was America's first truly big business, and its growth and impact were enormous. In the 41 years from 1830 to 1870, about 40,000 miles of track were laid in the country. But in the 20 years from 1871 to 1890, more than 110,000 miles were laid. In 1869, the first transcontinental line linking the East and West coasts was opened, and by 1900, there were four more. Remember, by 1890, annual railroad freight revenues totaled $1 billion, which was more than twice what the federal government took in. The railroads not only transported goods and people, they dictated where towns would grow and businesses would locate. They employed more than 1 million people by 1900. They pushed Congress to create four standard time zones across the country so train schedules could be worked out. The railroads created or greatly expanded other industries with their demands for materials like steel for rails and passenger and freight cars. And they helped speed development of America's telegraph system, because where the rails went, the wires went. With telegraph stations at most train stations, the Western Union Company was sending 40 million messages a year by 1883, over 400,000 miles of wire. Despite all those grand and glorious numbers, the railroad boom wasn't exactly a shining example of American free enterprise at its best. The rails were laid mostly on public land given to the railroads by the federal government, more than 240,000 square miles, or an area the size of Germany, along with more than $60 million in taxpayer-financed grants or loans. Because the federal government didn't want to get directly in the railroad building business, the land was thought of as an incentive to attract private investment. The idea was the railroad companies would sell most of the land near their tracks, and that's where they would make their money, because rail operations alone weren't expected to turn a profit for years. The system was ripe for corruption, and scandals were plenty. The Union Pacific Line, for example, was built by the Credit Mobilier Construction Company, which was owned by the same people who owned the railroad. They took fat federal grants and awarded themselves exorbitant contracts and bought off inquisitive congressmen with bribes of heavily discounted railroad stock. The business attracted titans of industry, or robber barons, depending on how you viewed them. There was Cornelius Vanderbilt in the East, Thomas A. Scott in the Midwest, James J. Hill in the Northwest, and Jay Gould in the Southwest. Each had his railroad fiefdoms and battled with the others for government favors. But not all the country's big wheels concentrated on trains. There were fortunes to be made in other fields, too. And dribble before you shoot. James Naismith had an unruly class on his hands. The Canadian-born YMCA teacher was training would-be YMCA instructors in Springfield, Massachusetts, in the winter of 1891. His boss had ordered him to come up with a new indoor game that would get the class re-enthused about exercise in the winter. Naismith tried variations of soccer and lacrosse. They proved too rough. After 2 weeks, he was still stumped. Then a solution began to fall into place. The first notion was to use a big round ball that didn't require a stick to hit it. Second, running with the ball was eliminated, so no tackling was required. Third, goals were set up through which to chuck the ball. "I met Mr. Stebbins, the superintendent of buildings," Naismith later recalled, "and I asked him if he had two boxes about 18 inches square. Stebbins thought a minute and then said, 'No, but I have two old peach baskets down in the storeroom.'" By noon, Naismith had nailed up the peach baskets, and 2 9-man teams were playing basketball, as opposed to what presumably would have been box ball. Manufacturing steel more efficiently. Before the Civil War, steel was a rare and expensive building material, mainly because the process to make it from iron ore was a lengthy one. But a method that became widely used in the early 1870s greatly shortened the process while greatly increasing the amount that could be made at one time. In America, steel making became synonymous with one man, Andrew Carnegie. Born in Scotland, Carnegie came to America at the age of 13 and got a job working in a Pennsylvania factory for $1.50 a week. He moved on to jobs with Western Union and the Pennsylvania Railroad, made smart investments, and by the time he was 28, was making $50,000 a year. Carnegie eventually focused on steel. He hired chemists to perfect the production process, developed markets for steel, reinvested his profits, and expanded. He bought up or leased vast holdings of iron ore and coal in order to corner the supply of raw materials. By 1890, America was producing 4 million tons of steel per year, mostly for the railroads, and 70% of it was made by Carnegie steel plants near Pittsburgh. In 1901, Carnegie sold out to financier J.P. Morgan for the staggering sum of $447 million. In his later years, he gave away more than $300 million of his fortune through philanthropies that included building 2,811 public libraries and donating 8,000 organs to churches. Refining and controlling oil. In the 1850s, whale oil, the primary fuel for providing light, had become very expensive, and people began to look for an alternative. Gradually, drilling for oil became practical enough that kerosene made from refined petroleum began replacing whale oil. The most famous, or infamous, of the oil men was John D. Rockefeller, a Cleveland businessman who had made some money during the Civil War selling meat and grain. In 1870, Rockefeller combined 5 companies he owned into the Standard Oil Company. A ruthless and brilliant businessman, Rockefeller either bought up the competition or drove it out of business by undercutting prices. Political bribery was also a standard tool of Standard Oil. One critic noted that Rockefeller had done everything to the Pennsylvania legislature except refine it. By 1879, Standard Oil controlled 90% of the nation's refining capacity, a huge network of pipelines and large oil reserves, and by 1892, Rockefeller had amassed a fortune of $800 million. the real thing. John Pemberton was an Atlanta pharmacist, but he was also a man with a vision. He wanted to make the perfect drink. So he came up with a syrup that combined the cocoa leaf and the cola nut. Mixing it in a big kettle, he lugged it down to a local drugstore where he sold it for 5 cents a glass and averaged 9 sales a day. Pemberton died in 1888, and the formula for Coca-Cola, a name created by Pemberton's bookkeeper from the two main ingredients, was sold to a clever marketing man named Asa B. Candler. Candler realized that advertising was the key to making the product a national brand and devoted an unheard-of $50,000 a year to marketing the drink. Other executives who followed him perfected distribution and bottling techniques, and today, billions of bottles and cans of Coke are sold in more than 200 countries. P.S. Among other things, Pemberton claimed his drink could cure headaches and dyspepsia. He made no rash claims about diet dyspepsia. Getting wired for sound and light. New industries were also springing up around new inventions. In 1876, a teacher of the deaf, Alexander Graham Bell, invented the telephone. By 1880, 85 cities and towns had phone networks, and by 1900, more than 800,000 telephones were in place throughout the country. In 1879, inventor Thomas A. Edison came up with a practical electric light bulb. Over the next 20 years, America began to wire up. At first, direct current, DC, was used. But DC didn't work over distances of more than a few miles. Then a man named George Westinghouse began using alternating current, AC, which allowed high voltage to be sent long distances through transformers and then reduced to safer levels as it entered buildings. Switching from steam engines to electricity made factories safer and more efficient, too. Forming trusts and striking against them. In 1882, Standard Oil organized the first of the nation's trusts. A trust oversaw virtually all of an industry's operations, from production to price setting to distribution and sales. It was supposedly run not by a single company, but by trustees. A trust issued certificates to stockholders in the industry's companies and paid dividends. Virtual monopolies like Standard Oil could then argue that they didn't control an industry. The trust did. Monopolies weren't all bad. Because of the economies of doing business on a large scale, costs could be kept down and prices lowered. The price of kerosene, for example, dropped a fair amount after Standard Oil dominated the market. Of course, with no competition, prices were at the mercy of the monopolies and could, and often did, swing up again. In addition, the sheer size and power of the monopolies were worrisome to some Americans. Carnegie and other giants of capitalism immodestly preached the gospel of wealth, arguing that it was natural for a few people to have most of the wealth, a sort of economic survival of the fittest. As long as they used their fortunes to benefit society, they contended there was nothing wrong with it. Remember, but opening libraries and donating church organs didn't put bread on the table of the average working guy. Labor unions began to try to do that after the Civil War by organizing on a large scale. Most notable were groups called the Knights of Labor and the American Federation of Labor, AFL. In 1877, America faced its first national labor strike when railroad workers walked off the job after wages were cut. State and federal troops were called in, hundreds of strikers were killed or wounded, and service was restored at the point of a gun. In May 1886, an AFL strike for an 8-hour day for workers led to a clash at Chicago's Haymarket Square between police and strikers. A bomb killed 7 cops and injured 67 people. The police, who had killed 4 strikers the day before, fired into the crowd and killed 4 more. 7 strike leaders were eventually convicted, and 4 were hanged. The incident was condemned by anti-union forces as an example of how the labor movement was controlled by anarchists and radicals. In 1894, a strike against the Pullman Railroad Car Company spread over 27 states and paralyzed the country's railroads. Federal troops were called out, and a court order ended the strike. The Haymarket Square riot and Pullman strike dealt severe blows to the chances of things getting better for the average working stiff through labor unions. America was progressing, but not all of its citizens were. Caveat emptor, chump. Let the buyer beware. That covers the whole business. You cannot wet nurse men from the time they are born until the time they die. They have to wade and get stuck, and that is the way men are educated. Sugar Baron Henry O. Havemeyer to a Congressional Committee Investigating the Sugar Industry, 1895. Electing a String of Forgettable Presidents. It's doubtful America ever had as many mediocre presidents in a row as it did between 1876 and 1900. It wasn't a case of boring elections. Party splits and the fact that winners got to milk the government for jobs made for intense and nasty campaigns. There were plenty of big issues, too, from tariffs to bank panics to civil service reform. But the men elected to deal with them were largely a forgettable bunch. Here they are, before I forget them. Rutherford B. Hayes, Republican, 1877 to 1881. Hayes was a Civil War hero who hated making tough decisions, so he avoided them. The Democrats controlled Congress most of the time he was president, so he accomplished little. He chose not to run for a second term and may not have been nominated anyway. James A. Garfield, Republican, 1881. Garfield was assassinated by a disgruntled office seeker 4 months after taking office. He was also the last president to be born in a log cabin. Chester A. Arthur, Republican, 1881 to 1885. Arthur was a lifelong politician who never won an election, except as Garfield's running mate. He was a fairly dignified and businesslike president, but he accomplished little. Grover Cleveland, Democrat, 1885 to 1889, and 1893 to 1897. Cleveland was the only president to serve 2 non-consecutive terms and the only one to have personally hanged a man. He accomplished the latter feat as sheriff in Buffalo, New York. He managed the former by losing his re-election bid in 1888 to Benjamin Harrison, and then defeating Harrison in 1892. His second term was marked by an economic depression. He didn't win nomination for a chance at a third term. Benjamin Harrison, Republican, 1889 to 1893. Harrison was the grandson of President William Henry Harrison. 6 new states, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, and South Dakota, were admitted during his administration. That was pretty much it. William McKinley, Republican, 1897 to 1901. By most accounts, McKinley was a nice guy. He was an Ohio congressman and governor and very devoted to his invalid wife. He also had friends in high places, especially political boss Mark Hanna. Hanna and others helped elect McKinley president. He defeated Democrat populist William Jennings Bryan in 1896 and again in 1900. He was assassinated by a crazy anarchist named Leon Czolgosz in 1901. As he lay wounded, McKinley urged that his killer not be harmed, but Cholguz was executed in the electric chair anyway. The rise of populism. Times were tough on the farm in the 1890s. Crop prices fell as production rose. Credit was hard to get, and interest rates were high. Many of the rural areas' best and brightest had taken off to seek their fortunes in the cities. Remember, these hard times triggered a political movement called populism. Populists sought higher crop prices and lower interest rates. They wanted a system where farmers could deposit crops in storage facilities and use them as collateral for low-interest government loans. They also wanted more money put into circulation and more silver coins made. The idea was that more money in circulation would raise crop prices, while their mortgage payments would stay the same. But it was also risky. Money based on the amount of gold reserves the country had was more stable than money based on silver, because the amount of silver reserves was increasing and therefore could cheapen the value of money as the price of silver dropped. Republicans generally opposed the populist ideas, while Democrats generally lined up with the populists. The Democrats nominated 36-year-old Nebraska Congressman William Jennings Bryan as their 1896 presidential candidate. Bryan, an outstanding orator, gave a rousing speech at the Democratic Convention in favor of free silver by exclaiming, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." But Bryan lost to Republican William McKinley anyway, in large part because McKinley supporters raised and spent a then staggering $3 million on his campaign. A splendid little war. When Cuba revolted against Spain in 1868, most Americans weren't very interested. But in 1898, when the Caribbean island rebelled again, America took notice. The difference was that by 1898, the United States was Cuba's best customer for its sugar and tobacco crops, and its biggest investor. So when the fighting destroyed American property in Cuba, the country's interest was aroused. Some Americans wanted to free Cuba from Spanish oppression. Some wanted to protect U.S. economic interests, and others just saw it as a chance to pick off some of Spain's colonies for America. The anti-Spain flames were fanned by New York newspapers that tried to outdo each other in reporting about Spain's atrocities. "You furnish the pictures," New York publisher William Randolph Hearst told an illustrator for his New York Journal, "and I'll furnish the war." In January 1898, the U.S. battleship Maine was sent to Havana when it was reported that American lives were in danger. On February 15th, the Maine mysteriously exploded, killing 260 U.S. sailors and officers. Possible and still unexplained causes ranged from a Spanish mine to an internal coal fire. It didn't matter. By April, America and Spain were at war. It was, in the words of one American official, a splendid little war. In the Philippines, a U.S. fleet, commanded by Commodore George Dewey, blasted a Spanish fleet, and U.S. soldiers easily took the islands. Cuba took a little longer to conquer, but the Spanish forces there also fell. The four-month war cost 5,642 American lives, all but 379 to disease, and a grown-up America now had the makings of an empire on its hands. How about Hawaii? The islands of Hawaii have always been a great place to visit for Americans. Yankee traders visited there in the 1790s. In the 1840s, the islands were home to American whaling ships. And by 1860, many U.S. citizens owned land there. In 1875, America dropped a ban on Hawaiian sugar that had been urged by U.S. sugar growers and became the island's best customer. And in 1887, Hawaii granted America exclusive rights to use Pearl Harbor as a coaling station and repair base for U.S. ships. But making Hawaii a U.S. territory took some doing. In 1893, white businessmen, looking for a way to exempt Hawaiian sugar from steep U.S. tariffs, led a successful rebellion against Queen Liliuokalani. The rebels promptly petitioned to be annexed to the United States. But President Grover Cleveland rejected the offer. The new Hawaiian government asked again in 1897, but this time the Senate rejected it. Finally, in 1898, Hawaii became a U.S. territory. In 1959, it became the 50th state. Chapter 13. Growing into the 20th Century, 1899 to 1918. In this chapter, Winning Colonies from Spain, Bringing in Teddy Roosevelt, Improving Conditions Across America, Getting America in the Air and on the Road, Fighting for Women's Right to Vote, Hunting for Jobs in the North, African American Style, Joining World War I with Woodrow Wilson. As the 1800s turned into the 1900s, America had just won a short and sloppily fought, but easily won, war with Spain. As a result, the country found itself, for the first time in its history, with an overseas empire formed by the colonies it won from Spain. This chapter covers how America reacted to its new role as a force to be reckoned with in the world, and how Americans handled changes in how they worked, how they got around, and how they governed themselves. Here today, Guam tomorrow, colonizing Spain's lands. At the end of the 19th century, the U.S. government suddenly had a lot more territory on its hands. There was Hawaii, which was formally annexed in 1898, and also Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, which were all won from Spain. Cuba was technically free, but because of restrictive treaties, it was in reality an American fiefdom. On February 6, 1899, the U.S. Senate ratified the treaty with Spain that gave the U.S. Guam and Puerto Rico. The Spanish threw in the Philippines, too, after American negotiators offered $20 million for the islands. The Senate vote on the treaty was 57-27, only two more than the two-thirds needed. The close vote mirrored a sharp division of opinion about whether it was a good idea for America to have colonies. Arguing about American imperialism. Imperialism is a political idea that sounds something like this. We can run your country better than you can because we have a better system of government. In practical terms, imperialists also view occupied territory as a sort of automatic teller machine for withdrawals of natural resources or as a great place for strategically located military bases. In June 1898, opponents to the idea of American colonies formed the Anti-Imperialist League, a group of strange bedfellows that included author Mark Twain, steel tycoon Andrew Carnegie, and labor leader Samuel Gompers. The folks who opposed imperialism all had different reasons for their opposition. Some believed it was un-American to impose American culture or government on other people. Others were afraid of mingling with inferior races. Laborers feared competition from poorly paid workers in other countries, and conservative business leaders feared foreign entanglements would divert capital. Proponents, led by Theodore Roosevelt, who was then governor of New York, argued that annexation would open the Orient for U.S. business. He said it would also prevent other nations from seizing the former Spanish colonies and better position the United States as a world military power. President William McKinley opined it was America's duty to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them, conveniently ignoring the fact that most Filipinos were already Roman Catholic. Such attitudes sparked a war with the newly liberated Filipinos. The war took several years and thousands of casualties on both sides before the United States prevailed. Fighting with the Filipinos. After suffering under Spanish rule for 350 years, Filipinos weren't keen on a continuance of domination by a foreign country. But America wanted to hold on to the islands for their strategic value as a base for U.S. naval operations and to protect U.S. business interests there. The result was what is perhaps America's least known war. In 1899, led by Emilio Aguinaldo, Filipino insurrectos, who had fought alongside U.S. troops against the Spanish, now took up arms against their former allies. Aguinaldo commanded an army of about 80,000. Many of the insurrectos lacked weapons other than spears or machetes, so the Filipinos resorted to guerrilla warfare and terrorism. American soldiers responded with a vengeance, torturing and executing prisoners and burning entire villages. After 4 years of fighting, 4,230 Americans and more than 25,000 Filipinos had been killed. After Aguinaldo was captured and took an oath of allegiance to the United States, the fighting ended. A U.S. judge named William Howard Taft, who would later become the 27th President of the United States, took over as civilian governor of the islands. Taft gave the Filipinos wide latitude in governing themselves. But formal U.S. control didn't end until July 4, 1946. Keeping a high profile in international affairs. To a large extent, the nasty fight in the Philippines soured the American appetite for imperialism. But protecting U.S. business interests overseas remained a priority, and a strong feeling still existed that the country needed to maintain a high profile in international affairs. No one felt that way more strongly than McKinley's new vice president, Theodore Roosevelt. McKinley's original vice president, Garrett Hobart, had died in late 1899, and Republican Party leaders added the headstrong Roosevelt to McKinley's ticket in 1900, mainly as a way to shut him up in the obscurity of the vice presidency. But on September 6, 1901, while visiting the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York, McKinley was shot by a self-proclaimed anarchist. The president died a week later, and Roosevelt moved into the spotlight. "Now look," cried GOP political boss Mark Hanna of McKinley's death and Roosevelt's succession to the presidency. "That damned cowboy is president of the United States." Making a lot of noise and carrying a big stick, Roosevelt takes office. Depending on whether you liked him or not, Theodore Roosevelt was either the energetic embodiment of the nation he led or a macho blowhard who really should have taken more cold showers. A puny, asthmatic child, Roosevelt literally built himself into a human dynamo with strenuous exercise and a non-stop personal regimen. His walrus mustache, thick round spectacles, and outsized teeth made him a political cartoonist's dream. However, his relative youth, at 42, he was the youngest president the country had ever had, his energy and his unpredictability made him the bane of GOP political bosses. Roosevelt was fond of repeating an old African proverb that suggested, "Speak softly and carry a big stick. You will go far." In practice, however, he was much fonder of the stick than of speaking softly. A leading imperialist under McKinley, Roosevelt relished America's role as policeman to the world, and he took great advantage of his position as the top cop. In 1903, for example, Roosevelt encouraged Panama to revolt against Colombia so the United States could secure rights from the Panamanians to build the Panama Canal. In 1905, he brokered the treaty that settled a war between Russia and Japan, for which he won a Nobel Peace Prize. In 2001, Roosevelt was posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his service in the war with Spain, the only man to win the top prize for peace and war. Remember, Roosevelt set the tone for presidents who followed him. Both William Howard Taft and Woodrow Wilson had their own versions of gunboat diplomacy, using force or threat of force to help negotiations along, particularly in Latin America. Technical stuff. The Panama Canal. Roosevelt considered the construction of the Panama Canal his greatest accomplishment as president. And so did a lot of seagoers. After all, it cut 7,800 miles off the voyage from New York to San Francisco by eliminating the necessity to sail around the tip of South America. The canal took about 10 years to build and cost $380 million. That cost broke down to about $7.5 million for each of its 50.72 miles. At the height of construction in 1913, more than 43,400 people were working on the canal. Approximately 75% of these laborers were from the British West Indies. Hundreds of workers died from disease or accidents. About 240 million cubic yards of earth were moved during construction. The World Series. For 25 years, the National Baseball League had squashed all challenges to it as the only major organization when it came to the national pastime. In 1901, however, a tough and savvy longtime minor league executive named Byron Bancroft Ban Johnson started an 8-team league of his own with franchises in major cities. Johnson's new American League lured many of the National League's top stars away with higher salaries. Forced to match salaries to keep its best players, the National League sued for peace and signed a national baseball agreement in January 1903, recognizing the American League as an equal. As part of the deal, the leagues agreed to stage a postseason world championship between the pennant winners in each league. The first of these, a best-of-nine games affair, was played in October 1903 between the National League's Pittsburgh Pirates and the American League's Boston Red Sox. To the shock of most baseball fans, the upstart league's Red Sox won 5-3. In 1912, Taft sent U.S. Marines to Nicaragua after a revolution there threatened American financial interests. In 1915, when Wilson was commander-in-chief, U.S. troops went to Haiti when revolution began to bubble. The troops stayed until 1934. In 1916, Wilson sent U.S. Army troops into Mexico under General John J. Blackjack Pershing. The troops were to chase Mexican revolutionary Francisco Pancho Villa, who had raided American territory. The punitive expedition, as it was referred to by the War Department, almost triggered a war with Mexico and added to a widely held notion in the rest of the hemisphere that Uncle Sam was something of a bully. The expedition was also an example of a U.S. tendency to get involved in other countries' affairs. The tendency, which sprang sometimes from idealism and sometimes from pure self-interest, would last the rest of the 20th century. Pressing toward political and social reform. While America was busy reforming other countries, a burgeoning movement for reforms was in full swing at home, in virtually every business and social institution. At the core of the effort was a loose and divisive coalition of journalists, politicians, and single-cause crusaders who, because they sought progress, were called progressives. These progressives helped turn the first two decades of the century into what's known as the Progressive Era. The Muckrakers expose evil and initiate change. The first step in many of the causes undertaken by the progressives was exposing particular evils. This was often done by reporters and writers who looked into everything from machine politics to child labor to the preparation of food. Roosevelt dubbed them muckrakers after a character in the 17th century allegorical novel Pilgrim's Progress, who constantly labored to clean up the moral filth around him. While journalists had written exposés for years, the muckrakers' impact was magnified by the fact that they were often published in a fairly new medium, the popular and cheap magazine. The magazines included McClure's, the Saturday Evening Post, and the Ladies' Home Journal. The muckrakers included Ida Tarbell, who exposed the inner workings of the Standard Oil monopoly, Lincoln Steffens, who wrote about the corruption of many big city governments, and Upton Sinclair, whose novel on meatpacking practices in Chicago, called The Jungle, made an entire country queasy. The muckrakers were joined in their quest for reforms by political figures at the local, state, and national levels, such as California Governor and then U.S. Senator Hiram Johnson.